Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
The Parthenon, atop Athens' Acropolis, alternately a cathedral, a mosque, and an archaeological ruin, was constructed nearly 2,500 years ago as a huge and lavishly decorated temple to Athena. Since then, it stood as the West's ultimate paragon of beauty and proportion. But has this universal symbol of culture and Western democracy been misunderstood over the centuries? In Joan Connolly's new book, The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the World's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It, she challenges our most basic assumptions about the Parthenon and the ancient Athenians while expertly recreating the world of myth, history, and religion. Joan Connolly is professor of classics and art history at New York University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So give us a sense of what brought you to this subject and wanting to give us a new understanding.
Well, in fact, I was not working on the Parthenon when this insight came to me. I was researching an earlier book on Greek priestesses. And in the middle of the Parthenon frieze, just above the door, there's an image of a woman that for the past 230 years has been identified as a historical priestess of Athena on the Acropolis, a real live woman from the 5th century BC. And while researching this book, I came to the conclusion that she could not be a priestess of the historical period. And that set me on a long journey of research that ultimately made me put that book aside and work continuously on the central panel of the Parthenon frieze, which ultimately led to this book.
What do you believe in our understanding of the Parthenon has been misunderstood?
Well, there has been a tendency to read the Parthenon through our own lens. This is only human. We look for ourselves in the ancient past. And so from the Enlightenment onward, this object of supreme beauty drew people to it. And when people are drawn to something like a magnet, they then wish to see themselves in it. And so it was held up as this paragon of Western values, of democracy at the core. What I do is start with religion as my point of departure, not politics. And I look to the way the Parthenon sculptural program is a crucial way in to how the ancient Athenians understood their building. And let us not forget, it was first and foremost a temple, a deeply sacred space. If you engage with the religious paradigm, you see something very different in the building.
You write in the book, and you make this point very, very clear, that knowing and seeing the people who made it and seeing them as they were is very, very important.
Oh, absolutely. And it is a strange and mysterious world for us. Antiquity is as foreign a world as we can imagine. And though we like to see what is familiar to us, it is by looking at what is unfamiliar to us that we learn the most. For example, this understanding that the Athenians had of themselves and where they came from, the most urgent of all human questions, where do I come from? Well, they had this mystical sense of themselves and their past. They believed in a supernatural world that was more reminiscent perhaps of fantasy fiction than our own sense of reality today. In particular, the Athenians believed and acted as if they were all descended from the same mythic figures. And so each citizen was devoted to all, as if in a family. They believed that they were special, that they were autochthonous, sprung from the ground itself, the result of Hephaestus's desire for Athena. And so when they look to the sculptures of the Parthenon, what they're looking at and what the sculptures show is a genealogical succession of one generation to the next, to the next, to the next, and ultimately to the historical Athenians. If we engage with this, we can then understand what the Parthenon means above all.
I want you to talk a little bit about the phrase and its importance, and why you came and how you think you have reinterpreted it for us in a sense that shows us a whole new light.
Well, if we look at the Parthenon in comparison to other Greek temples of its time, and this is the thing about something as beautiful and iconic and a masterpiece status, we tend to look at it in isolation rather than as a temple among temples. But if we read the Parthenon, as I do in the book, and compare it to other temples of its contemporary moment, we will see that on the east end of a temple, the most important end, that is the end where the front door is, and opposite the great altar where sacrifice is performed, this end regularly shows in its sculpture a scene of the mythical founding family of that city. If we look just a moment to Olympia, which is the greatest temple to immediately precede the Parthenon, the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, on its eastern side, in the pediment, that is the gable, there is no frieze on Olympia's temple to Zeus, but in the gable on the east side, we see the mythical royal family and how Olympia and the Olympic Games came to be. We see King Pelops and Onomaos, we see Hippodamia and Queen Steriope, we see the royal family standing in a solemn lineup, just as we see on the Parthenon frieze, standing there waiting in anticipation of the tragic moment. And so, for starters, instead of seeing the Parthenon frieze as it has been done since the 18th century, as a snapshot of history, as a 4th of July parade, a sort of civic procession that happened annually, and if this were true, the Parthenon would stand outside of the norms for all Greek temples, which always showed subject matter from myth, not from reality. But we never had a myth to fit. And all that I have done is recognize the myth of an early family of Athens, King Erechtheus and his wife Praxithea, and their three daughters who had to die to save the city from tragedy. We knew about this story, but it was not until the 1960s when, in what I can only call a remarkable series of events, a papyrus fragment that was lost, that contained the story of a lost play by Euripides, one of the greatest playwrights of the 5th century BC. This was peeled off of a mummy casing that had been excavated in Egypt in 1901. When we recovered this papyrus fragment in 1963, we got 120 new lines of this important play, a play that was produced at Athens just 10 years after the completion of the Parthenon, and which in fact tells the same story as the frieze. And now we can understand it to be yet one more in the genealogical succession myths told on the Parthenon sculptures, the most recent one, the one at the very end of the Bronze Age, when the first family of Athens was surrounded by barbarian invaders. The king goes to the Delphic oracle and says, "How can I save the city?" And the oracle says, "You must sacrifice your youngest daughter." And her two older sisters had pledged a sacred vow that if the little girl died, they would jump from the Acropolis in a suicide pact and kill themselves in solidarity with their sibling. And so when we look at that central scene, what we see are a man, a woman, and three girls. The girls are preparing to die. And the message is that at Athens, no one family, not even the royals, not even the most elite people of the city, can put themselves above the collective good. At Athens, the 1% gives their lives to save the city, just as every other citizen would. And it's a very beautiful and powerful message.
Voluntary sacrifice for the common good.
Absolutely. That's it.
You talk in the book about the Elgin marbles, and I want you to put that into a context for us. They are not a part of this site. They're with the British Museum, and you conclude that they should be brought back to Greece so that this work of art, this single work of art, can be viewed as its creators intended it. Tell us a little bit about how you came to that conclusion of how indeed that would be the intention, and why that is such a significant move.
Yes, well, of course, the Parthenon sculptures, a large percentage of them were taken down by Lord and Lady Elgin and their agents in 1802, 1803, and brought to England, where they eventually made their way to the British Museum. And so at present, we have about 40% of the Parthenon sculptures still in Athens and 60% outside of Athens, most of them in the British Museum, some individual fragments in the Vatican, in Palermo, in the Louvre, etc. Now, when studying for the last really 18 years, nonstop, working on the Parthenon every day, eat, drinking, and sleeping it, it does put you in a different frame of mind than if you think of the Parthenon sculptures maybe every 5 years or so when you land in London and want to go and have a look at them. What happens is I understand them clearly. They were not made as standalone objects, as objet d'art, that mobilier that were meant to move. They were made as part of a building that still stands in the middle of Athens today. And they derived their immediate and most urgent meaning from their proximity to one another. And so I can show that on the west gable, we see the river god Cephissus, and he is the father of the naiad nymph Praxithea, who is shown on the east frieze. And she goes on to marry King Erechtheus, and is the mother of these three girls. So you see, the sculptures communicate with one another. They're showing a layering of time, pushing ever back into distant eons of the past. In fact, we start with the birth of Athena, and then the contest of Poseidon and Athena for patronage of the city, and Athena wins, but Poseidon's son is angry, and he comes back in the next generation to challenge Erechtheus, who marries the daughter of the river god on the front of the temple at the west side. And so you see, they derive their meaning from one another. And I even think that perhaps, just perhaps, one of the reasons the frieze has been misread for the past two centuries or so is that we haven't viewed it as a continuous narrative. On the Parthenon itself, it would have wrapped around that exterior colonnade, and it was of a piece that you walked around it. As displayed in the Duveen Gallery at the British Museum, it is shown inside out, and it is chopped up into bits, separated by doorways and hallways and lots of breaks within it. And so we can't view it as it was meant to be viewed, and therefore it chops up our comprehension and understanding of it. The new Acropolis Museum in Athens, of course, has built a gallery that is exactly the size of the Parthenon, where the frieze could be shown right way around, and that you could circumnavigate the core of the gallery, which is the size of the Parthenon, and see it as it has not been seen since it was removed, as a continuous narrative, as something that is part of a program of sculptures that derive their immediate meaning from the context of the Athenian Acropolis.
You've been out and talking about the book, and of course it's been getting wonderful reviews. I'm curious as to your thoughts on bringing this to a general audience and making it resonate so that people understand why this is so important.
Well, of course, the Parthenon is and will ever be one of the most iconic buildings in the world. And so this is something that if the broader public knows any building in Greece, they do know the Parthenon. It's important that they also know what it means and the profoundness of its message. I have to tell you that bringing this building and bringing this new understanding to the broader public has been one of the most thrilling experiences of my life. The letters that I am getting, I'll just mention one. I got a letter from a combat veteran in Illinois, and he wrote and said, you know, before your book, I never had the language to express what it feels like when you lay down your life for another. I didn't know how to express it myself, but you gave me words, and to be connected somehow with the emotions of the ancient Athenians, who lived this and who believed it and who really developed this notion of the ultimate sacrifice and how precious it is. And think of this. We think of no greater love than this, than to lay down your life for your brother, and we think of it very much as part of a Christian tradition. But 450 years before Christ, in this play, The Erechtheus, we hear in the voice of Queen Praxithea, no one family may put itself above the collective good. Of course I give my child to die on behalf of all so that they might live. And these very beautiful words, which I think are not separate from their notion of democracy, which for them was a sacred trust amongst the citizens. Well, you see, to explore this world, to help a broader public to see that they too are connected to this march of human life, that human beings have been thinking and feeling this way from 450 BC, it brings a great deal of comfort and hope and interest and trust to a broader public. I love this letter. He says, I served in combat, and I feel connected to those Athenians who did the same, and now I know how to express what that feeling is. And you see, this is what scholarship should be about. It's not for a small group of academics. It is something to be shared, and each generation looks at the great monuments through fresh eyes, and all I'm doing is building on the work of the many people that came before me. But I do think that it has a message that resonates with humankind and is an important message and gives us a lot to reflect on.
The name of the book is The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the World's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It. Joan Connolly, a great pleasure to have you share your expertise on our program this morning. I thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
A delight. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the World's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It. The book is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.